From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is the second installment of the 2016 Good Food Piecast. We started off with this vintage Pillsbury commercial from the early 80s.
Just compare Pillsbury Already Pie Crust to Scratch Crust.
Bet you can't tell which crust is scratch and which one is already. Bet you can't tell which crust is scratch and which one is Pillsbury.
Pillsbury Already Pie Crust, fresh from your dairy case.
Fast forward to 2014. We're at the Kentucky State Fair Pie Contest, and Linda Horton has just entered a buttermilk pie. She won the contest the previous year. In an interview with the local paper, Linda mentions her winning pie was made with a store-bought Pillsbury crust. Perhaps she forgot that this was against the contest rules. But before we take a dig at Linda, we call Dr. Theodore Leotis to find out what's in a ready-made crust. He has 30 years of food science experience at General Mills, PepsiCo, and Campbell Soup. Hi, Doctor.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm great. So one of the first ingredients in the Pillsbury pie crust is partially hydrogenated lard. Why would they choose to use partially hydrogenated lard instead of something like Crisco, which is a partially hydrogenated vegetable oil?
Yeah, okay, very good question. Well, I mean, lard by definition is a fat that consumers have used that is of animal origin. Actually, it's fat that originated in the belly of a pig, okay? Lard has been a staple for cooking for centuries, and it's solid at room temperature, and it's very stable. So people have used lard to make different desserts, pie crust. Obviously, you need some solid fat to give it the body and the substance, you know, of the crust.
Why have hydrogenated oils been so common in commercial food products?
Now, over the years, because of health concerns and about the bad publicity that animal fats have received, companies and consumers has gradually switched into vegetable-sourced fats. The problem with vegetable-sourced fats, as you know, most of them are liquid. They're actually oils. So the industry has to find a way to make those liquids more solid to give us the same consistency and structure that we were getting out of the animal-derived fats. And this is where hydrogenation as a process comes into play.
So now I'm really curious why you would have to hydrogenate lard. And what is that process like, given that lard is already a solid?
So that's what the ingredient statement reads on the Pillsbury pie crust. It may be that they're using a combination of animal and vegetable fats that they don't have exactly the consistency they want, and therefore they partially hydrogenated to make it a little harder.
Now let's talk about the hydrogenation process.
Yep.
It's a mystery to us.
Okay, it's very, very easy to understand, actually. As I said earlier, when you go into vegetable, and when I say vegetable, I mean like grains, nuts, like peanut, like olive, all of these oils, and why they're so healthy is because a lot of their bonds that connect the carbons on the molecule, they're connected with unsaturated bonds. Therefore, at room temperature, around 70, 75 Fahrenheit, these fats are actually liquid. If you want to make something, an application that requires structure, like butter, you need something that is harder. So what they do is that they take the liquid oils, subject them into a chemical reaction that adds basically hydrogen atoms and saturates a portion of those unsaturated bonds, okay? The difference of that now is that because some of the bonds have been hydrogenated, it raises the melting point, and at room temperature, the consistency of this, it's actually solid. It may be very hard, or it may be very soft hard. A good example to explain this is cocoa butter. That's why cocoa butter that is in our favorite chocolates, of course, it's so good because it melts exactly at the body temperature of the mouth and you don't have that waxy taste in your mouth.
Now, I want to ask you about the health implications of the hydrogenation.
Sure.
Does the actual process create something in the structure that makes it less healthy for us?
Yes, it does. I'm sure you and a lot of consumers have heard of the word trans fatty acids.
Yes.
That have been in labels, and now they're starting to be regulated by the government. as an undesirable result of the hydrogenation process, because the manufacturers that do hydrogenation, they can't really control exactly where the hydrogen atoms go on the unsaturated bond, they create the so-called trans fatty acids. A trans fatty acid has been proven that is not good in a sense that it raises the LDLs and the total cholesterol in our diet and affects actually atherosclerosis and a lot of disease that have to do with the chemistry of cholesterol in our blood. However, they have also come up with a process now to filter those trans fatty acids out of the reaction. Today, when you see hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated fat, it's not necessarily bad for you as long as it has zero trans fats.
Okay. So now let's move on with this recipe. Mm-hmm. The next ingredients are BHT and BHA. What are they?
BHT and BHA are essentially preservatives that they preserve the flavor of fats and oils. Because we have fat in this recipe, this partially hydrogenated lard, it still has unsaturated bonds. What we need to remember is this. An oil, the more unsaturated bonds, the more susceptible this oil is to oxidation. And what oxidation means? Essentially, some of these bonds, they get actually broken by oxygen radicals during shelf life. So what happens in oil that has high unsaturated bonds that has been oxidized, it smells like rancid. So in order for these manufacturers to preserve the flavor of these partially hydrogenated lards or vegetable fats, they have to add BHA and BHT, which essentially protects the remaining unsaturated bonds on these fats.
And so then the potassium sorbate and the sodium propionate do that for the liquid that is in the recipe to bring the dough together.
Okay. The dough essentially is a mixture of flour, fat, and then we have water. The water part is the ingredient that makes the dough susceptible to microbial growth. And as we know, when we make dough at home, or how long can you keep it in the refrigerator? Maybe a week or something like that, right? Then you will see already some growth of maybe yeast. Then you may see longer periods of time in your refrigerator. You may see some green stuff, pink stuff growing on it, which is mold. And in order for the manufacturers to extend the shelf life, now they're adding the water-based preservatives, which is the sorbates and the propionates.
I have to ask you about enriched bleached flour, which is
right.
Also part of this product.
Right.
Why bleached? Is it just so it'll look prettier for us?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, we're used to the visual appeal of baked goods. It's a very good point, a very good appealing, because as we know with food, us humans, we sample food with our eyes, right? Second, we sample food with our nose. And the third is actually when we taste the food in our mouth. So obviously, in that sequence, visual appeal of the food is very important to us. So it can make us excited about eating the food. A long time ago, that was done in decades ago, manufacturers decided to enrich it. So you have basically flour that is enriched with the B complex. So a lot of this stuff that you see in the parentheses there, niacin, thiamine, riboflavin, folic acid, they're actually all vitamin B. And as you notice at the end, they're adding two food colors. The reason for that, for those two food colors in there, is to actually give that ready-made dough a nice yellowish color so it's appealing and it's not like stark white. And then when it bakes, of course, it will give you that golden color.
So many chemicals. It would just be so much easier to make your own dough at home.
It is. That's why a lot of people sometimes, I understand the rule on the contest you were describing, to where people, you know, make the stuff from scratch. Now, when you make it from scratch, obviously, you're not going to be using preservatives. The one thing that would be, in my opinion, the most significant effect on whether it's store-bought versus scratch is the two food colors. Just simply because, in my opinion, they affect the visual appeal of the dough. And if somebody was making it out of scratch, they wouldn't be using yellow 5 and red 40.
Yeah, but I think that home bakers compensate by doing what's called an egg wash.
Yeah, and therefore the skill in the competition. To do an egg wash, you know, sometimes you can go heavy, you can go light. It's actually an art.
Yeah, it's true. Well, thank you so much. It's been fascinating.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Theodore Leotis. We reached out to him at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he's a research professor in the food engineering department. A word to the wise, don't pull a Linda and cut corners if you're submitting pies in our contests. Our judges are scary savvy. Even if your store-bought crust slips through the cracks, your conscience will haunt you.
Alice, who left all that gorgeous pie?
The boy said the crust was too tough. Guess I'll have to
throw it away. Ridiculous.
Instead of my usual Crisco, I used a cheaper shortening.
You didn't use Crisco. Why?
To save money.
Oh, but this is how you really save.
Crisco?
Uh-huh. A Crisco pie crust only costs about a penny more. Talk about flaky, tender crust. And you don't have to worry about wasting this expensive filling. Bet your boys won't leave this on the plate.
If there's any left to leave.
Worth a penny more?
Crisco sure is a bargain.
Crisco, only about a penny more for really flaky crust.
What's a word you think of when I say moist?
Like a cake?
Fungus.
How about the word flaky?
Dandruff.
Cereal.
Hair.
How about furry?
Puppy. Stuffed animal.
Frasier.
Okay, how about when I put two of those words together? Like moist fur.
Wet cat.
Moist fur. Yeah, wet cat is pretty good.
Yeah. Okay, how about the word flaky crust?
Pie.
Yeah, pie.
Pie.
Pie. Pizza.
Have you ever taken a bite of a baked good and thought, wow, I could eat six more of these? And then you take another bite and your friend says, can you believe it? It's vegan. And your jaw drops. So to help demystify vegan baking pie for me, I brought in a ringer, Clara Polito. At only 19 years old, she's a baker and chef who's also the owner of her own company, Clara Cakes, right here in Atwater Village. She's also a judge in our pie contest. I think you're going to be the youngest judge.
Really?
Yeah.
Who's the second to youngest?
I think there's a really big leap in between. Clara, let's start with the basics. Making vegan pie crust, do you have a go-to fat that you use instead of butter?
Yeah, the go-to fat I use would be Earth Balance, which is the vegan butter you can find in most supermarkets. It works just like butter, never fails me.
There's Earth Balance in a tub, and then there's Earth Balance baking sticks.
I use the Earth Balance in the tub. The baking sticks is a little more expensive, more luxurious. When I get to use it, I'm really happy because it's less messy. But I normally use the tub.
I love it because when I first asked you what you use, you said butter. Because for you, it's your butter, right?
Right. Yeah, I know. I don't even think about it. I'm like, oh, yeah, wait, it is vegan.
Can you substitute in that fat for any fat in a crust recipe, or do you have to add additional flour or change it in any way?
I use it exactly the same way you would use typical butter, except there isn't an unsalted version of Earth Balance. So normally I just add in less salt than what the recipe would normally say. Make sure to taste it so it's not too salty.
I actually really love salty crusts, especially if I'm filling it with a sweet filling.
Me too.
Yeah, that sweet and salty thing is pretty good. Now, I've always wondered about using coconut oil in a crust, and I get asked that question a lot, and I have to confess I've never tried it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried making crust with coconut oil?
I've used coconut oil for more of shortbread, cookie types of crusts, and it works really well for that because it has that sort of melt-in-your-mouth flavor, and coconut oil is really good with that. You still like taste the coconut, but then you also have that nice meltiness to it.
So it has that great kind of sandy, crumbly texture.
Yeah. And I like to use that in combination with Earth Balance just so it's not completely flaky. Like it can hold its body.
And do you follow special recipes when you're using coconut oil? Because it becomes liquid so fast. I would imagine it's kind of messy.
I really just kind of half and half the butter with the coconut oil. And if it seems too greasy or something, I'd maybe add a little bit more flour. But I'm always just really careful not to overdo it with the flour. Otherwise, it loses that nice flakiness.
When you're working with vegan fats, what are some of the obstacles? Do you have to worry about temperature a lot, about keeping everything cold?
Whenever I use like a vegan fat, I'm not too concerned about it melting. I do like to chop up the butter about like 10 minutes before I start the pie dough, and then I stick it in the freezer just so it's super, super cold.
And then do you have any techniques as to how you bring the dough together that reinforces the flakiness?
I never use a food processor, especially when I'm just making my own pie crust. I just love being able to bind the dough myself and everything. I guess one trick that I use is I keep the flour in the freezer.
Oh, you do?
And that keeps it nice and cold.
That's a good tip. What about ideas for savory versus sweet vegan pie crusts? Do you always use the same one?
I like to use the same one because the one recipe I use is so complimentary towards both. Like last night, I made a white peach raspberry pie with the same crust that I used for a quiche this morning. And they're both delicious with it.
So you're on a roll.
Yeah, literally.
Going beyond the crust to the filling, I noticed on your website that you offer a lot of cream pies. What do you use instead of milk? Do you use almond milk?
Normally, instead of milk, I would use soy milk. I never really use almond milk. I just really like soy milk's consistency. And then I also use Morinu silken tofu, the extra firm kind. It comes in little non-refrigerated boxes. You could get it at like health food stores and online.
And describe how you use it.
Normally I would puree it with all the other cream ingredients in a food processor.
And you don't need to cook it at all.
There is a step where I cook the cornstarch and soy milk and sugar and cocoa powder or whatever sort of ingredient I'm using together so it's super thick. Then I add it to like the tofu and then blend it. And then it becomes like that pudding-like sort of filling.
Do you get any taste of the tofu?
No. That's the amazing part. It's such a mellow tofu to begin with. As soon as you're adding the sugar and the salt and lemon juice or cocoa powder, banana, it tastes like normal pudding.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I really have to try that.
Definitely.
I have to move beyond my prejudices.
Yeah.
Well, it's lovely having you back again, and thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
That's Clara Polito. She's the mastermind behind Clara Cakes. You can serve a slice of your pie to her, only vegan pies, of course, at the Good Food Pie Contest on October 2nd. For the past couple of years, we've had a special world category in our contest. Past entries have included a Japanese citrus yuzu pie and a pie with a Nazca art-inspired face baked into a lattice crust. This year, we dedicate our La Cubana category to Afro-Cuban artist Belka Sayon, featured at our venue, UCLA's Fowler Museum. If you're new to Cuban flavors, we have just the guest to inspire you in the kitchen, Marta Darby. Her blog is My Big Fat Cuban Family.
My family's from Cuba. My parents, my great-grandparents. So, you know, for generations back, we are Cuban through and through. My family had to leave the island in early 1961 when the Castros had taken power. We were refugees for a while, political refugees. We moved to Florida. We lived there for a few years, and we eventually moved out to California and have been here ever since.
One of the few things that your mom brought with her from Cuba was an old Cuban cookbook.
That is correct. There's a famous Cuban cookbook author. Her name was Nitza Villapol, and she stayed in Cuba years and years through the revolution. She was actually turned out to be a communist. So my mom had this dog-eared, very well-loved cookbook, and that was one of the few things that she managed to bring with her. Seriously, it was miraculous. So we were able to enjoy the food that was so comforting and familiar to us when we got here to the U.S.
So how long ago did you decide to put a focus on this food of your heritage and start blogging?
I live in a very suburban neighborhood here. We were, you know, going to soccer games and all the things, but I kept a lot of my Cuban heritage. I would make picadillo or arroz con pollo or, you know, all different kinds of Cuban foods. I thought, you know, I wonder if there's other people who who remember their childhood so fondly and the foods that they grew up with. So I started just writing about my memories and about what my family did and how we did keep our traditions.
So let's talk about that picadillo.
Yes, ma'am.
I saw that you had a picadillo pie.
Yes.
Describe what yours is like.
First of all, the picadillo is basically just ground beef with the perfect Cuban spices. And by the perfect Cuban spices, I mean like a sofrito. The holy trinity of Cuban food is garlic, onion, and bell pepper, chopped up into small pieces, sauteed in olive oil with a red sauce of some sort, some tomato sauce. And that's the basis of most Cuban cooking. Well, I decided one day to try putting those into a pie. I thought this would work. And I made these little mini picadillo pies. And boy, I was the hit of the neighborhood.
I love all the family anecdotes that you talk about in your blog, especially giant empanadas that Santa Barbara lost. I expect that you're referring to the saint Santa Barbara.
Yes. This is some kind of a Cuban idiom, but where something is unusually big, my mother said, well, that's the one that Santa Barbara lost. So I had gotten a pie shell and made an empanada out of it. I just, you know, filled half of it with the Saint Picadillo, which is my favorite go-to meat, and just sort of folded it in half and turned it into an empanada. And again, you know, this just makes me very popular at parties.
So there's another kind of sort of empanada filling or pie filling that I think of when I think of Cuban cuisine, and that's guava paste.
Yes. I know this is radio, but let's have a moment of silence for the beauty that is guava paste. Guava is obviously found on a tropical island. We Cubans love guava pastry. If you could find a bakery that sells guava pastry, you're going to get the guava pastry. I would make guava pastry by sort of cheating and taking puff pastry and guava paste, and I like it with cream cheese. And to be able to make your own guava pastry at home, that was like discovering fire.
Well, Marta, thank you so much for sharing your passion.
All right. Thank you so much, Evan. It's been a pleasure.
La televisión cubana, Senta Cocina al Minuto. Guión y dirección, Nixa Villapol.
Muy buenas tardes, amigos televidentes. Con ustedes una vez más, como siempre, Cocina al Minuto con recetas fáciles y rápidas de hacer.
That's a clip from Nitza Villapol's Cocina al Minuto from back in the 60s. She's kind of like the Julia Child of Cuba. That's it for this year's 2016 podcast. Find recipes, tips, and answers to frequently asked pie baking questions on our blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Thank you so much to everyone who made this second installment of our podcast possible. That's Jackie Liu, Abby Fentress-Swanson, and our awesome engineers, Joel Stein and Kat Yore. I'm Evan Kleiman, the Master Chief Pie Doctor. Not really. See you October 2nd.